Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for joining me. Next week, on the 11th of February, it's the 80th anniversary of the signing of the Lateran Pacts. To mark this special date, I'd like you to step back in time with me to a different era, that of the papacy of Pius XI, who, for the record, was elected as 258th successor of Peter on the 12th of February 1922, and who died on the 10th of February 1939, 10 years following the signing of these pacts I just mentioned. I'll be doing this in a very personal manner by shining the spotlight on the years leading up to this date and those immediately following it, dipping both into the sound archives of Vatican Radio and into my own archives, bringing you the voices of some of those who were there, beginning with Pius XI, of course, in a somewhat crackly recording of the time.
Mentre milioni di uomini vivono ancora in ansia per l'incombente pericolo.
The voice of Pope Pius XI, a voice Count Carlo Cardelli remembered very well.
Pius XI was very impressive. He spoke very slowly and with a very dignified attitude. But he was very solemn because he was very dogmatic, always sort of correcting himself, very attentive to the choice of his words, saying, as we should say better, to say it more precisely, in other words, what we mean to say is, therefore, in his court, they called him il professore.
Count Cardelli's family belonged to the papal aristocracy, so as a young man he was often received in audience by the Pope. He remembered being struck by the more scholarly side to Pope Pius XI, the fact he was a keen scientist, a librarian, and indeed former prefect of the Vatican Library. Others, like Princess Orietta Doria Pamphili, were impressed by the seemingly contradictory side to the papal personality. The intellectual Pope with the shiny spectacles was also a man of action and a sportsman.
Pius the 11th was Pope then, the Paparatti, and he was a great mountaineer, of course.
What is your memory of him as a person?
Oh dear, I never thought of it. I think he was sort of fairly stocky, a mountaineer build, really, a fairly stocky man, and energetic, yes. I remember going to an audience as a child. I can't think why I was taken along. And in those days, all the children wore white, and the ladies all wore black. It was a private order, of course. You had a black dress down to your feet, and the men had a morning coat, or at least a dark suit. And it usually was a Bachamano audience.
What is a Bachamano audience?
With the private audience, I think you sort of sit in his study. A big audience is when you all sit in rows on benches. And the Bachamano, a row of people round the room, and the Pope comes in, and literally you kiss his hand as he goes past you. And he'd say a few words to people here or there or to each family or group or whatever.
Was this an important part in your life, the audience with the Pope, or was it a regular feature in your life?
Oh, no, it was the only time I think I remember going to an audience. I mean, we weren't a black family. We weren't all connected with the Vatican in any way. In fact, we used to get the invitation to the tribune of the Roman nobility, then my father declined it at one stage.
You speak about the black aristocracy as opposed to the white aristocracy. Can you explain?
1870, when Rome became the capital of Italy, the Pope retreated to the Vatican. The black nobility, the ones that shut their doors on the state, on the Italian state, and stuck with the Pope, and the white were the ones who went with the state. And as my great-grandfather was the first deputy mayor of Rome in 1870, of course, we were with the state and not with the Vatican.
It was 1870, and unlike the Doria Pamphili family, Marquis Mario Teodoli's family did stand with the Pope. Not only did that mean they were part of the black aristocracy, but that his father was a colonel of Pius XI's Noble Guard, who made quite sure his family was present in St. Peter's Square when a pope was elected.
The noble guards represented a higher class guardian of the name of the pope and the pope, and they followed the pope. So go to Piazza San Pietro when the pope was nominated. I remember it was Pius XI who was the first one who, after being elected pope, blessed the Roman population that was standing in Piazza San Pietro. I think that was the first time that he walked into that balcony and blessed the population here. The other popes before that never did that.
Pius XI's first gesture was unexpected. A pope had not appeared on the balcony looking out towards St. Peter's Square towards the Italian state since 1870. Despite being taken by surprise at seeing the pope appear at a window that had been closed to Italy for 52 years, the crowds lost no time in cheering, and more astonishingly, the Italian troops responded to the gesture by presenting arms. It was to be the first in a long line of decisive gestures Pius XI was to make, in an effort to pave the way to a reconciliation between church and state. The Italian state Pius XI had to deal with was a fascist one. Mussolini had marched on Rome during the first year of the Pope's pontificate.
Di terra, di mare, dell'aria.
And 3 years later, during a ceremony in St. Peter's Basilica to mark the holy year of 1925, the Italian state was represented by a member of the fascist party. On this occasion, Count Carlo Cardelli witnessed what could have been a diplomatic incident.
It was very, very impressive. We entered the tribune reserved to the Roman nobility much in advance, and we had to wait a long time. I remember one episode which risked to become a diplomatic incident. The ambassador to the Holy See of Italy, the first ambassador of Italy to the Holy See, was Cesare Maria De Vecchi, the Valcismone, one of the quadrumviri of Mussolini, and he arrived late. There was no place for him, but he was entitled to be, I think, the first in rank. So they produced very quickly a chair, and he was sitting near and before the dean of the diplomatic corps, and looking very crossed.
4 years after this episode, on the 11th of February 1929, Pius XI became the last of the five popes to be a prisoner in the Vatican. On a rigid and rainy day, Mussolini for the Italian state and Cardinal Gasparri for the Holy See signed the Lateran Pacts. The bells rang out from the council hall in the Lateran Palace. From that day, Vatican City became an independent state. Catholicism was declared the only state religion, and a financial agreement between church and state was reached. Pius XI was satisfied. He'd finally settled the Roman question, and is said to have remarked, "I have given Italy back to God, and God back to Italy." But despite the Concordat, it took Pius XI a while before he left the Vatican. And when he eventually did so, it was in secret.
One day, we came back, our contra member I had been, I came back to the embassy, and I found consternation. The Pope had disappeared. It was around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The Pope had disappeared.
Father John Charleroux, son of the French ambassador to the Holy See at the time of Pius XI, recalled the general amazement in Vatican circles when one evening the Pope suddenly disappeared.
Anyway, around dinner time, the message came that the Pope was in Castel Gandolfo. And what had happened, it's that the Pope had been given Castel Gandolfo, which had belonged to the Prince Barberini before, when I was a small child in my first stay in Rome, by the Lateran treaties. A summer residence, the Italian state kicked out the Barberinis and gave that to the Pope. But the Pope had taken such, was so accustomed to be closed up in the Vatican, that it took him from 1929 to 1934, 35, not very vague in my memory, but all those years before he decided to move and to attempt to go out of Rome and to go to Castel Gandolfo. Nevertheless, the change was considered so great that he tried to do it secretly. And so it was in hot weather already. He chose the hour where everybody was doing what they call in Rome ora scabrosa, because everybody is having their siesta. And he put on the black cassock that he always had hanging in his room, with which he had climbed Monte Rosa as a young priest. He was very proud of that. And with his secretary, he ordered a car, not a papal car, to go secretly when everybody was asleep to Castel Gandolfo. It so happened that around Grottaferrato, I don't know where, the car broke down. The secretary, not wanting to say who was in the car, had went to fetch for help. One couldn't mend the car. To cut a long story short, it ended by a couple of ox being towing the car to Castel Gandolfo. So it took them all that time to reach Castel Gandolfo. It gives you the atmosphere of what, still, after the Treaty of the Latins, was the relation of Rome to the Italian state.
I hope you enjoyed that feature I put together for you. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.